Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker, and good evening also for the recorded broadcast this evening. Before I start this program, I'd like to welcome new listener Julie Linton, whom I've known nearly forever, who has had the misfortune of finding this program on the internet in Estacada. So, welcome, Julie. Well, this is sort of a potpourri this morning. We have oil, trees, and war, the big three of human endeavor and involvements. I'd like to start with a poem by Seaside's own Billy Lutz, who managed to email this thing to the station. It's called A Large Mole on the Gulf, Part 1. There is a large mole on the Gulf. It's growing fast and changing color, probing, scanning, and analysis say it's worse than any other. Family gathered in the waiting room. Women sob while men engage in conversation. The loss becomes most problematic while discussing financial implications. Insurance agents and lawyers in waiting draw up lines of defense, carefully worded documents unveiled to rebut angry interests demanding payments. Immediate remedies are largely topical, dispersing visual evidence according to advisors. Harsh chemicals sink sludge to the bottom, and the public is none the wiser. Virtual realities have their perks. 21st century contact on a 35 millimeter reel. All emotion examined through the flat screen, turned off when our stasis starts to squeal. Tomorrow we'll have much better prospects. If not in the news, it doesn't exist. British Petroleum isn't such a bad fellow, the vehicle of our shopping lists. And yet the purge continues. Amazing is the degree of disconnect. As the lady lies literally bleeding, her wild life rhythm shaken to the quick. Every one of her sons and daughters worried of their own narrow affairs, unless it directly influences pocketbooks or rocks world market shares. Having never smelled pristine air anyway, being distracted by constant din and clatter, having become inured to incremental decimation, what does one more mess really matter? New reality resides in the mind. New nature is pixelated. Life-giving water in throwaway bottles. Sustenance boxed, shipped, and refrigerated. All that translates across the nation. Our shrimp will be more expensive. Gas will go up for some perverted reason. Frightened interests become more aggressive. Then comes a short burst of feeling better. Engineering doctors will staunch the bleeding. A few ducks and turtles are dead, but the economic heart resumes a tenuous beating. News downplays expanding disaster. Corpuscles up and traveling interstate veins, except for a few of the old school who track vibrations of yin and yang. Where are those who don't despise nature? Commodity a death term of arrogance. They who speak of disaster think economic, interrupting status quo an act of vengeance. Another day dawns over the Gulf. Here at home, tourists order up bagels. A mysterious blob lurks beneath the ocean surface. Self-inflicted ignorance and bloated spirit enables. Part 2. 6 weeks in shows no abatement, and now hurricane season is upon us. Actual panic and realization creep in, apocalyptic talk and despondence. Still, the spiel is economic only, as if the wound is but a scab on the surface. Calamity lurks beneath, unseen and abysmal. corporate man has no head to take notice. Environmental groups get no attention. Where is the Christian coalition now? Business has no ethical platform. The earth is but a cash cow. 8 weeks now with a temporary cap. 20% capture. Pretty pathetic. Florida closes its beaches also. Industry hunkering down in the panic. It seems we are at war with ourselves, the tug of desires entrenched in tradition. It is desire itself which manifests these disasters, the drug addict in need of rehabilitation. Addicts stay sheltered till they hit bottom, shaken false foundations of pride or position, curtains pulled from self-delusion, a mental sinkhole just off the kitchen. Collective schizophrenia, not a theory in a clinic. Self-loathing over failings we hold dear. Every resolved conflict in our head, acted out in the public square. I know oil is ubiquitous, in our goods, our diet, in the air. I know how many jobs it requires to get it from the ground to out there. Work is work, it shows in statistics. Employed change jobs every 5 years. The ones who claim stake of vital importance incidentally make millions in their careers. Now jobs are hostage takers. Conservation will cost more than a few, yet every problem leaves in its wake an opportunity to improve worldview. Collective consciousness is not to be equated with forced collectivism of the industrial age, where independent spirit was crushed to quell a collective sense of outrage. It means to be left alone to pursue interests without being corralled into centers of power. Passive nature of agrarian mindset, humanity craves in this dangerous hour. Can it be expected to affect such a mindset when established powers covertly fracture our natural sense of decency and respect, and make us glorify some goddamned rapture? Remember as far back as you possibly can, first infantile gaze into nature. I mean down so low to the ground, to when ants evoked awe and splendor. If who is revealed in that mirror's recollection proceeded from this day forward, darkest hours would yield to dawn's light, and dawn would be hope's new metaphor. Childlike is not childish, nor is passive equated as weakness. Connectedness isn't atheism. Ego has nothing to do with uniqueness. Clear-sighted, childlike vision and discipline guiding the advance. Connectedness graciously showing the way, and God linking the eyes to the ants. And that was by Bill Lutz, A Large Mole on the Gulf. And now from oil to forests. You probably are aware of the new forest plan for our local forests, which includes increased logging and the lawsuits that are now in process against that. And of course, Patricia Roberts' apologies for the apologia she wrote for the Daily Astorian, for the County Commission, Clatsop County Commission, of which she is a lame duck. So I woke up this morning with a serendipitous thought and wrote down what I had to say. It is actually something that I more or less wrote a few years back, and found it and rewrote it. Trees are us. We read in here about the massive destruction of the rainforests of Asia and South America, yet somehow find it difficult to equate our own clear-cutting of forests in this country. The great North American forest has virtually disappeared in little more than two centuries from the East Coast to the Pacific, from the great conifer forests of the North to the hardwoods of the South, in particular a huge swath across the top of the nation from Maine to Oregon. Little is left of Oregon's old forests and the forests of Northern California and Washington, and what little remains is increasingly under threat. Less than 10% of old-growth timber remains in the Pacific Northwest, which includes British Columbia. Though the forests of B.C. are intensely logged, they are not in U.S. jurisdiction, even though they are a vital part of the region's ecosystem. The economy of the Northwest is largely based on forest products. The problems and complexity pertaining to forest use focus on employment, endangered species, shrinking habitat, land erosion and water pollution, disastrous fires that consume hundreds of thousands of acres each season and kill animals and firefighters, climate change, methods and extent of logging, especially clear-cutting of old-growth forests, access and use of public forest lands. The never-quenched hunger of the timber industry has butchered its own lands, replacing them, when they do, with inferior and less profitable monocultural tree farms. Incredibly, the timber companies demand as almost their divine right the public forests, and as they log off more and more public timber, they demand more of what is left. Here in Astoria is the same situation in microcosm, trees versus money, the threatened long-range loss of our local ecosystem in exchange for short-term profit. We have in Astoria a wonderful forest, something most cities lack and many wish to have. This small remnant of a much larger forest on the hills above the Columbia River is instrumental to the quality of life many of us wish for ourselves and our successors. Others do not share sympathy with that vision. Trees are economical units to them, to be harvested to meet market demands without consideration for aesthetics or ecological value. The Pacific Northwest is in the same shape as Astoria. Its resources have been ravaged, and the greed for what remains will not end until all of it is gone. Trees, fish, and everything else despoiled for single-generation profit, one generation succeeding another in its desire to exploit whatever the market demands. Yet the glory days of logging are about to end. We have a simple dramatic choice: to either allow loggers to keep their jobs until they have cut down the remaining old-growth forests, or keep what is left at the cost of their jobs, which they will lose anyway when the last trees are cut down. Automation has accounted for most timber jobs, contrary to claims by the timber industry. Also, shipping raw logs to Asia and shutting down American mills because of cheaper costs. Timber companies and environmentalists push at each other with little inclination to compromise their positions. I favor the environmentalists. The loggers have had their day. They have denuded our forests and showed little inclination to replace what was lost on their own lands, and as a result are voracious in their demands of a mandate of public forests for their chainsaws. And here is a paradox, not among managers who see trees as nothing but ciphers on ledgers, but in the attitude of proud, rough-neck loggers who regard themselves as woodsmen, men who profess to love the forests they destroy and refuse to quit until nothing is left. When the last of the big trees are gone and the poor grade second and third growth timber shortens the ledgers, the managers will diversify their portfolios and dismiss the woodsmen who created their wealth and make restaurant dishwashers and busboys out of them. Without the forests of Asia and the Americas, we bequeath our descendants an arid world, a hot greenhouse, no shade to shield us from the sun's ultraviolet rays. We've virtually ruined our upper atmosphere ozone. Water systems dry up without the cooler, moist climates of forests. Biological diversity disappears. Marine life vanishes. Maybe only hallucinogenic drugs will recall the ancient symbiosis with Earth before our species moved out alone to dominate our home planet through obliteration of all that made it home. Yet we might be emerging from a long period of exploiting Earth's natural stocks to the realized necessity of preserving them. The blatant abuse and misuse of nature might now be reversed as ever-increasing numbers of humans wish to preserve the remaining ancient forests that were young when Shakespeare was alive and which have survived in their own unique and experienced responses to the conditions of their naturally symbiotic lives. A lesson we should learn from them. And that is something I wrote and woke up this morning thinking about. And I should probably give my disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. And I finish the program with war. Sixty years ago tomorrow, June 25th, 1950, the Korean War started with an invasion of South Korea by North Korea. Although an armistice was signed in 1953, 3 years later, and combat operations, which by then involved Chinese and United Nations forces, opposed to each other, of course, the war has never truly ended and is, at this moment, quite ready to be ignited again, perhaps waiting for tomorrow's anniversary to start it all over again. I.F. Stone wrote a book in 1952, The Hidden History of the Korean War, in which he puts forth a well-documented assertion that Chiang Kai-shek and South Korean Prime Minister Syngman Rhee welcomed the North Korean invasion because it would force the United States to intervene in force, which would save Syngman Rhee's toppling political fortunes and forestall mainland China's plans for invasion of Taiwan, known then as Formosa, where Chiang Kai-shek had retreated after communist armies led by Mao Zedong defeated his nationalist Chinese government on the mainland. Stone had a much disputed but never disproved slant on the start of the Korean War, which he wrote for his first Eye of Stone Weekly in 1953. Which I would like to read now. And he called it, New Light on the Korean Mystery, Was the War No Surprise to Chiang Kai-shek? And the article is reprinted from the first issue of I.F. Stone's Weekly, January 17th, 1953. The Senate report on Joseph McCarthy makes it possible to throw new light on one of the most tantalizing episodes in the Korean War. This concerns the burst of speculation in soybeans on the eve of the war. In touching on McCarthy's own successful flyer in soybeans later that same year, the report asks whether he had confidential information with respect to the trend of the soybean futures market, quote and unquote, and adds an intriguing parenthesis. It says, just prior to the transaction in question, the Commodity Exchange Authority of the Department of Agriculture conducted an investigation of alleged soybean market manipulation involving, among others, a number of Chinese traders. And that's T-R-A-D-E-R-S. The report on McCarthy is not too intrepid a document. It was not surprising, on inquiry at the Department of Agriculture, to discover that the Senate Subcommittee on Privileges and Elections had omitted from the report its own biggest news scoop in the soybean story. Inquiry at the department turned up, 1, the full text of a report of its investigation into soybean speculation, and 2, a list of the Chinese who took part in this trading. And this, he's talking about nationalist Chinese on Taiwan. The original report issued on August 10, 1950, passed almost unnoticed at the time outside grain publications. It withheld the names of the Chinese speculators, but in the file of the Agriculture Department's later press releases on the subject, there turned up a statement of last November 26th, which would be 1952, saying that the Senate Committee Subcommittee on Privileges and Elections had asked for the names and addresses of the Chinese traders referred to but not identified, quote unquote, in the original report. Attached was a list of names with their holdings in soybean futures when the Korean War began. The department declined to identify the names further, but one of the largest speculators on the list turned out to be T. V. Sung's younger brother, T. L. Sung. T. V. is, of course, Chiang Kai-shek's brother-in-law. One of the smaller speculators was Nationalist China's executive director on the board of the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. These directors are appointees of the governments they represent. Though such names confirm what had hitherto only been suspected, that insiders, and that's a quote, close to Chiang and his government, played a prominent part in the speculation. The Senate committee did not even mention its discovery. If the Korean War was a surprise attack, how is it that Chinese close to Chiang began to speculate in soybeans in the weeks before the fighting broke out? The question was first raised by the Monthly Review in its issue of October 1951. A footnote to Korea by the editors Leo Huberman and Paul Sweezy called attention to the unsuccessful effort of the late Senator McMahon during the MacArthur hearings to elicit information from Secretary of State Acheson on reports that certain Chinese had cornered the American soybean market at the time of the Korean War began. The footnote put that obscure colloquy into new and startling light by coupling it with an item published 2 months later, on August 16, 1951, on the financial page of the New York Herald Tribune. This item said some 50 Chinese living in the United States and abroad had cleaned up $30 million in speculative operations in soybeans just before the war. Just how extensive these operations were was not clear until now. The original Department of Agriculture study to which the McCarthy report calls attention shows that Secretary Acheson was perhaps less than candid in his answers to Senator McMahon. The senator wanted to know whether Acheson had ever discussed with Secretary of Agriculture Brannon a corner that's supposed to have existed in the soybean market a year ago last June in the hands of certain Chinese in this country. And that's a quote from McMahon. A year ago last June was when the Korean War began. And that was 1950 he's speaking of. The casual listener would assume from the Acheson replies that the matter was of little importance and that little was known about it. Secretary Acheson, yes, I have discussed it with him. Senator McMahon, is there anything you can say at this time concerning the personalities who were engaged in that operation? Secretary Acheson, I don't know that I ever knew who the personalities involved were. And that's from page 2187, volume 3 of the MacArthur hearings, that being the Douglas, General Douglas MacArthur hearings. In the light of the information now turned up, this I don't know that I ever knew seems superbly evasive. If the Secretary of State discussed the matter with Secretary of Agriculture Brannon, they must have considered it of more than routine importance. Brannon could hardly have failed to tell Acheson that a full investigation had been made by the Agriculture Department's Commodity Exchange Authority and that the names of all the participants were known, as the report of August 10, 1950 shows. This neglected report begins to indicate the full dimensions of the skeleton the Secretary of State wished to keep securely closeted. The story the Department of Agriculture report unfolds begins several months before the Korean War. The war broke out on June 25, 1950. 4 months earlier, the Commodity Exchange Authority of the U.S. Department of Agriculture began to receive a large number of complaints, and that's a quote, from processors of soybeans in this country that the soybean futures market had fallen so completely under the control of speculators, again a quote, that it could no longer serve for legitimate hedging operations. One complainant pointed out that more soybeans were being traded on the Chicago market than all the other principal grain futures combined. Another, that the sudden sharp rise in soybean prices is helping only the speculators, as a large majority of the farmers have already disposed of their farm holdings. And that's a quote. The Commodity Exchange Authority began to investigate and found very sizable trading by persons with Chinese names and in some instances with Hong Kong addresses. Speculation in futures by Chinese is not unusual, but no previous instance had been found, it said, in which Chinese held as large a proportion of the total open contracts in any commodity. The Commodity Exchange Authority wondered why the Chicago Board of Trade reduced speculative margins on soybeans on March 13th from the already low level of 8.3% to 6.1% in the face of an active market. In the 4 weeks which followed, the daily average volume of trading rose to 15 million bushels a day as compared with 10 million daily in the preceding 4 weeks. Since few suspected that war was coming in the Far East, it was thought that Chinese nationalist interests were trying to corner the market. On August 7, 1950, the Chicago Journal of Commerce carried a front-page item stating that the president of the Chicago Board of Trade had refuted previously published reports that a virtual corner of soybeans by Chinese nationalist interests had been instrumental in causing prices to soar from $2.20 to $3.45 a bushel. The refutation was made to look somewhat sickly when 3 days later the Commodity Exchange Authority issued its report on speculation in soybeans, the report from which the quotations here were taken. This showed that by June 30, 1950, 56 Chinese accounts held almost half of all open contracts for July futures on the long slide of the market, i.e., of those playing for a raise in price. The inference is irresistible, though not necessarily correct, that inner Chinese nationalist circles knew war was coming and cashed in on their knowledge. If this ugly inference is false, the nationalists should be anxious for a congressional investigation, which would clear them of suspicion that a group of them made themselves a nice little profit of $30 million on a war which has cost the American people and its allies heavily in lives and money. It may be, of course, that they had informers in Red China who tipped them off to a coming attack from North Korea. It may also be, as I indicated in my book, The Hidden History of the Korean War, that Chang and Syngman Rhee provoked the attack from the north. It should not be forgotten that in this, as in any other unsolved crime, it is useful to begin by determining who benefited. The biggest beneficiary of the Korean War was Chiang Kai-shek. The war diverted the Chinese Reds from their plans to attack Formosa, which is now Taiwan. It gave him a virtual American protectorate over Formosa and an increased flow of American aid. The $30 million in that perspective is small change, but an investigation into that small change might throw a flood of new light on the origin of the conflict, which threatens to engulf the globe in World War III. And that was I.F. Stone writing in 1953, the year the Korean War had its armistice.